On April 3rd, 2003, three men robbed a Houston check cashing store, shooting and killing the clerk, Alfredia Jones, as well as the responding officer, Charles Clark. An eyewitness saw the men flee to a local housing project. Two of the men, Deshaun Glaspy and Elijah Joubert, were soon identified and arrested, but they protected the third man by pointing the finger at Dwayne Brown. Deshaun Glaspy cut a deal for his testimony against Dwayne, and a second eyewitness was coerced into supporting that testimony. But Dwayne was at his girlfriend Erica Dockery's apartment at the time of the crime. He had called her at her workplace on the apartment's landline, and Erica corroborated that story. The prosecutor soon charged Erica Dockery with perjury for her grand jury testimony, sending her to jail for 4 months away from her kids and causing her to eventually start telling the story that he wanted to hear. With no more alibi witnesses and no phone records presented at trial to corroborate his story, Dwayne, a man they knew was innocent, was sent to death row. This is Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom. Welcome back to Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom. You're about to hear the story of Dwayne Brown. This case involves an innocent man sentenced to death, a district attorney who knew he was innocent before he prosecuted him, and witnesses that were coerced is too light of a term. With us today to tell the story is the man who is primarily responsible for getting him out, Brian Stolarz. Welcome to Wrongful Conviction.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
And of course, saving the best for last, we have the man himself, Dwayne Brown. Thank you for being here and welcome to Wrongful Conviction.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And sorry for everything that you had to go through to get here to be here, but so happy that you're free today. So let's go back to the beginning. Where did you grow up and what was your life like before this tragedy happened that you ended up being falsely blamed for?
Well, I grew up back and forth in Texas and Louisiana with my mom, but I mainly stayed in Louisiana. Out here is just straight country, you know. It's a lot of fun if you like being out here in the open. That's where I live at now. It's peaceful.
Okay. And Brian, can you take us back to the crime and how the hell Dwayne ever got his name thrown into the mix when it should have been clear to everyone that he wasn't and could not have been a part of this scenario?
On April 3rd, 2003, three men robbed a Houston check cashing store in South Houston called Ace America's Cash Express. There was an inside job. Someone who worked there said there was going to be $300,000, a huge drop of money. So people were conspiring to steal it. Three men went to go rob it, and the clerk who was there that day turned out to not be the woman who gave him the inside tip. She got cold feet, decided she didn't want to be there. So a woman named Alfredia Jones, who had just had a baby, 27-year-old woman, and she opened the door. She got bum-rushed by one of the guys. They asked her to open the safe. She says, I have to call to let my boss know I'm here. She calls, but she uses the code for I'm being robbed. It was I'm opening store 24 or something like that, and that was code for I'm being robbed. Officer Charles Clark, a 45-year-old decorated veteran of the Houston Police Force, almost on the verge of retirement, was nearby. They were towing cars for impound. And he happened to be nearby, so he went to the scene and was murdered, tragically. And Alfredia Jones was murdered, tragically. And the wrecker driver, who was with the cop, had driven by the scene and saw three men rush out. And the three men went to a housing complex, got rid of some clothes, you know, sort of tried to get out of town. Now, two of those men, we know, one of them was arrested the next day, Deshaun Glaspy, and another man named Elijah Joubert. Glaspy was 21, Elijah 23. Now, there was three men. Glaspy and Joubert sort of conspired to tell them that Dwayne Brown was the third guy. And they had several interviews with the cops. They were getting the third degree. And Glaspy cut a deal. He agreed to plead guilty to armed robbery only and take a 30-year sentence in exchange for testifying against Dwayne and Elijah Joubert in separate trials. Elijah Joubert was charged with murdering Alfredia Jones, and Dwayne Brown was charged with murdering Officer Clark.
So they got to charge two people with capital murder, which we know Texas loves their death penalty, right? And these guys didn't want to implicate the third guy for whatever reason, the actual third guy who was known to them. But how did it come to your attention that you were a suspect in this case? Did they just bust down your door one day?
My mom had came, got me. Somebody told her that what was going on. So she was asking me, what's going on? I said, I don't know. She said, well, if you wasn't there, let's just go turn yourself into the police station. And they pulled me over right before I got to the police station.
Did you know that this was what they wanted you for?
No, I didn't.
So you just were going in to see what was going on, pretty much.
Right.
And then did you ever see Free Air again after that moment?
Oh, no. Once they put them handcuffs on me, I didn't turn them loose until 12 years later.
Listeners of our show know I've had Rob Will and Rodney Reed, two innocent men on death row in Texas, on the show. I can't even imagine what 12 minutes on there would be like, much less 12 years. But you're here to tell the tale, which is great. And, you know, how it happened to you and how it got undone. Brian, if you could walk us through some of the dirty tricks that they used in order to fabricate this case and to condemn an innocent man.
You know, the whole system broke on Duane. Now, there's never been and never will be any science that ties Duane to this offense. No DNA, no gunshot residue, no fingerprints, no nothing. And so they had to get this conviction through witness testimony because they already had Deshaun Glaspie, who agreed to plead guilty 30 years, testify against them. But by law, they've corroborated the snitch's testimony with evidence. But they had none because they had no science. And I realized pretty early on when I got the case on habeas, which we'll explain later, that this was corrupt from the very, very beginning. And it manifests itself in a couple different ways. First, witness intimidation. You had one witness named Sharonda Simon who had told the police that she did not see Duane the morning of. They apparently had all congregated at a housing complex. She said that she didn't see him. The police and DA pressured her, frightened her, and said, if you don't say that you saw Duane that morning, we're going to take your kids away. She was living in a housing voucher, had a child with cerebral palsy in a wheelchair, wanted nothing to do with the police. They made her life miserable. They came by every day. And so she said, fine, I saw him there. So that's one piece of witness that said that they saw the morning of. But Jason, nowhere was the investigation more corrupt and I think more broken than in the grand jury process involving Erica Dockery. Now, Erica Dockery was Duane's girlfriend. And Duane had an alibi from the very beginning. He was at Erica's apartment on the morning of the murder and made a phone call to where she worked. And so she goes to the police station and tells that exact thing. When I left for work that morning, he was there. And yeah, later that morning, I was working as a home health care aide to an elderly woman. A phone call came in. I looked down on the caller ID box, which incidentally I have to explain to anyone under the age of 30. But on the caller ID box, it said her house. The elderly woman picks it up. It's Duane, hands it to Erica. She tells that to the cops. And then she gets put in what's called the grand jury. For those of you who are not criminal defense lawyers, a grand jury is an investigative body of members of the public, but I have to get to that later too, is how this was also skewed. Members of the public sit and listen to the evidence. And if there's enough evidence to proceed, then the grand jury says, yes, prosecutor, you may proceed with a charge against that defendant. Then a charge is lodged, and then you get to the trial stuff like you see on TV. Erica goes to the grand jury and says this. He was there when I left that morning, and the phone call came in. And there's a moment where it all turns. Now, Erica's uncounseled. She goes in there and tells the truth. During a break, Dan Rizzo, the prosecutor in this case, who we hear a lot about, takes her into a locked room and says, if you don't say what I want, if you don't tell me the truth, my truth, you know, you're going to go jail the rest of your life or maybe die. And then she goes back in the grand jury and the grand jurors themselves start badgering her and threatening her and pressuring her, saying things like, come on, Erica, don't worry about that guy. Think about your kids. Tell us the truth. And she holds firm and tells the truth. And then afterwards, Dan Rizzo decides to charge her with perjury. Why? Because he could. He asked for a high bail for her. She's not violent, has no prior convictions or anything, but asked for high bail because he can, because he knows that she'll sit in jail because she can't make the bail. She sits there for 4 months, loses her job. Her children get raised by her cousin. And finally, she's like, screw it. I don't care. Just get me out of here. And she agrees to get out, plead guilty, says, fine, I lied. And then she says at trial that Duane was not there when she left. And yes, she got a phone call, but it was not from her house. And really, she is the most pivotal witness because we talked to jurors. So really, her testimony was fabricated and manufactured as a result of pressure from the grand jury and pressure from Dan Rizzo. And that happened with not only her, but another witness, Shronda Simon. The grand jury process in Texas was built broken. Houston impaneled grand jurors by what's called the pick-a-pal grand jury system. Pick-a-pal sounds something more fun than grand jury, but here it is. A judge would appoint a commissioner, usually a donor or a friend. That friend would go get their friends, and they'd go to the grand jury together. And it was typically older white folks sitting in judgment of minorities in one of the most diverse cities in the country. And the foreperson of the grand jury in a police officer shooting investigation was himself a police officer. That is the system that Erica Dockery found her in. And so she testifies against him, Ms. Simon testifies against him, and Glaspie. And that's it. That puts an innocent, good man on death row.
Yeah, and it allows at least one of the actual perpetrators to get off light, as well as the third actual perpetrator escaping justice entirely.
That man, we did a thorough investigation of who we believe the third person to be. We go to the DA and we say, here's the guy we believe it to be. We lay it out chapter and verse. And I said, investigate this guy. Swab his DNA. Investigate him. Go interrogate him. Do something. They didn't. He was in jail for a armed robbery. This man gets out and murders someone in a drug deal gone bad. Now,
wow.
So you talk about public safety. The cascade of wrongs here led to that man who was murdered by this man.
So, Dwayne, you lived through this already totally insane tornado of bullshit, but you weren't being represented by Brian yet. And while awaiting trial in Harris County Jail, your attorney, Loretta Muldrow, came to you with a deal. Not much of a deal, though. 40 years in prison in exchange for a guilty plea, which is suspect to begin with in a case in which a police officer had been killed. But that's beside the point, because even though she advised you to take the deal, you stood your ground.
Yes, Miss Loretta Muldrow. She told me to take the deal. She was like, you've been in here a year. You'll do 40 years. You'll come home on parole and all that. I'm like, I didn't do this crime. Would you still sign? And she said, yes. And I told her, if you didn't do it, so here you go. Sign the papers and you could do the time, because I wasn't finna do it.
Good for you. And yeah, if they really thought that he murdered a police officer, nobody's offering you anything that allows you to ever go free again. So there was some undercurrent to that offer right there. And we know it, and you know it, and I know it, and they knew it. But you did the right thing. Now it comes to the trial.
And again, when I say the whole system broke on Dwayne, I don't just mean the prosecution, police work, the investigation, the grand jury, which was corrupt. I'm talking about everything. He didn't have money to hire an attorney. And there is now, but at the time there was no public defender system. So it was private lawyers that were willing to take the case on a reduced fee. And Loretta Muldrow took the case. Dwayne tells her the alibi, and she does not issue a subpoena to the phone company. And I'd asked her later when I got involved, I was like, why didn't you ask for that? And she's like, I didn't think they'd have them. And I was like,
God,
a man's life stands in the balance. She said, well, I used to work there and I didn't think they kept landline phone records. That's the distinction she makes. And that's where he made the phone call from. And that's really critical, Jason, because if he was the landline, he was there at the house, could not have been at the crime scene. You needed a Superman cape to get there. So then she presents that defense. But when we talked to the jurors, they were like, but where's the evidence of the phone call? And so she could not prove that he made the phone call and didn't put a single piece of evidence in for his case. There was a critical alibi witness, Reginald Jones, who lived with Erica and Dwayne, who was there, who saw him come down the stairs, you know, at a certain time, which would have given credence to the fact that he was sleeping. He was actually asleep during this murder. Maybe she didn't call him. She didn't try to subpoena the phone records. And he gets found guilty, to nobody's surprise.
This episode is underwritten by the AIG Pro Bono Program. AIG is a leading global insurance company, and for over a decade, the AIG Pro Bono Program has provided thousands of hours of free legal services and other support to nonprofit organizations and individuals most in need. More recently, the program added criminal and social justice reform as a key pillar of its mission.
This episode is brought to you by Stand Together. Stand Together is a philanthropic community dedicated to helping people improve their lives.
For more than 20 years, Stand Together and its partners have been on the front lines of criminal justice reform. By empowering people to take action, supporting nonprofits, and working with businesses, Stand Together tackles the root causes of problems in our communities and empowers those closest to the problems to drive solutions. Solutions like reducing unjust prison sentences through the First Step Act, empowering community-based programs that help people reenter society, and now working to bridge divides in our communities. To learn how you may get involved, visit standtogether.org/conviction. The Innocence Files on Netflix covers Dwayne's case, so you can get a deeper look there. As well, you can check out the whole story in Brian Stolarz' amazing book, Grace and Justice on Death Row. Now, Dwayne, you're convicted and sentenced to death row. Can you tell us about what your initial experience was like in that hellhole?
Oh, man, when I got there, first thing they said was get undressed butt naked. It was like, I was just shocked, I guess. And I was like, man, I get butt naked, go see everybody and the doctors and all this. And when they put you in that cell, man, it's like, it's unreal. 7 footsteps sideways and 13 forward. And I'm 6'2", and I guess my arm is another 2.5 foot tall, I guess, long. And that was the ceiling. I can put my palm of my hand on the ceiling. And I stayed there 23 hours a day.
You could put your palm on the ceiling. So this is almost like a living tomb that they put you in, basically.
Right. I would say this roof is maybe 8 foot tall, I guess. If that, 9 foot tall, and you get fed through the slots, through the door, it's not right. That cell is not designed for any man to be in that long term. It messes with your mind. And I thank the Lord that I didn't come back out crazy or nothing, because I did see some people just lose it in there. It's not right at all.
Now, I know that they had a suicide on death row this week in Texas, and I imagine you probably saw your share of that as well, because you're exactly right. I mean, that is no place to put any human being.
When they first put me in the cell, I didn't have anything. No picture, no letter, no address to write anybody or nothing. The only address I had was my grandmother's address, and that's because I remembered it by heart. No phone calls. You had to put in a request for a phone call. And it would take 30 days or longer to even get it. It was, man, the cell was just empty. It was cold and it was nothing. They didn't even bring me a bunk until I want to say the next day or the day after that. And only way I started getting something, it was a guy, we called him 50-50. That was the first person that gave me a coffee cup, a noodle to eat, or anything, soap, anything. It took me a good little while to adapt, I guess you could say.
That's 23 hours a day during the week, 24 on the weekends. Where would you go for the extra hour during the day?
Either to the rec yard or to the barricades, what I call it. Because all you can do is look up. You got 20-foot walls all the way around you. And it's no bigger than the cell.
Right, so you go to an outdoor cell, basically, 1 hour a day.
No, twice a week. 3 days in the day room, and you got 2 days outside. Got to get butt naked anytime you leave the cell or going back to the cell. I used to call it my favorite part of the day just to make the guards mad.
Call it the favorite part of the day because why?
Just to make the guards mad.
Why would you make them mad?
They got to sit there and look at you, lift your penis up. And a lot of the officers, they don't want to look at that. So I will say, hey, it's time to get stripped out. It's the favorite part of the day.
Jeez.
I say that, they would look at me in my face like, man, you crazy.
Well, you took a dehumanizing part of it and made it humorous, which shows your grace and your inner peace.
Okay, so how did you find out that Brian was going to take your case?
When I first met Brian, he was talking, and I was like really just letting go out one ear into the other because I really didn't trust him because I thought he was going to be like Loretta Marjo and Robert Marjo and, you know, talk good but don't follow through with it. But it took me 3 years to trust him, and he stayed at it. So he was consistent with it, and I thank him for that. He kept fighting for what he believed in, and I love him for that, for real.
And Brian, he had every right to be skeptical. He had been let down or screwed, really, by everyone.
Yeah, you know, I can understand why he wouldn't trust me because of how he had been wronged by his trial lawyer. And he actually even had a second lawyer who was his direct appeal lawyer who also didn't do, you know, great job for him. So I was his, it's called habeas corpus lawyer, which is for the non-lawyers on this. It's just, it's anything else you could find about the case. Like usually it's for DNA and other new evidence. And it took a number of times of me going back down there and really not talking about the case. And I showed interest in who he was. One of the only beautiful things about going to meet him was it was all behind glass on phones. I could bring $20 to the vending machine quarters to buy him whatever he wanted for food, because the food there obviously is terrible. And like, it was my favorite part of going, because we had little mini Thanksgivings every time. And I'd buy him, you know, an appetizer, a main course, and a dessert. And one time they had key lime pie. You would have thought it was freaking Christmas. It was just like the greatest day ever. And he lined up a Hawaiian punch, a cheeseburger, and a key lime pie. And we sat there and talked for hours. And over time, we began to trust each other. And I began to truly love him and believe that this was my mission as a lawyer and a person. And things would happen, like, you know, we get an affidavit from a critical witness, or we would tell him that we had a court hearing. And he realized I was actually doing real work for him and cared about him deeply. I'm glad he trusted me.
Can you explain habeas corpus? Because the literal meaning is you shall have the body, right? It's medieval Latin.
What you're telling the court is you have the body and I want it out. And you are doing that by raising anything new. Newly discovered evidence can be raised in a habeas corpus petition. And that's what we took on with my prior law firm, K&L Gates. Pro bono. Got a bunch of people who are, you know, committed to the mission. Casey Kaplan, Bethany Nickfar, Chris Tate, Megan Whistler, all these folks who I just love dearly for helping me. And helping Dwayne. But that was our mission, the habeas corpus brief. And so what we would submit would be 275-page brief. And in that brief, we discovered, we put all the new evidence we could find, all the affidavits from the witnesses who described the pressure and the threats.
So now we're in 2011, right? Erica Dockery, let's talk about her.
She is the most critical witness. I got a hot tip on where she lived. I'd fly down to Houston, go knock on her door. She'd slam the door in my face. Because the last time she got involved in this, she went to jail. But here is where the case turns for Dwayne. Anthony Graves, who's exoneree number 12 from Texas's death row, Dwayne is number 13. So by that standard alone, they've executed over 500. Dwayne and Anthony are like living unicorns. And so Anthony Graves gets out and he says, a lot of guys belong there, but your guy doesn't. So what can I do? And that beautiful moment of paying it forward. I'm forever grateful to Anthony. I said, I can't get Erica to talk to me. I just want to find out what the truth is. And his girlfriend had been pressured in Anthony's own case. So he's like, I got you. He goes and talks to her and says, hey, just talk to that fast-talking lawyer. And she said she would. So I flew down on a Sunday, had lunch at a Cajun restaurant. And I said to her, I can't take your kids away. I can't do anything to you. Just tell me the damn truth, please. And then she starts to sort of cathartically cry. And I said, was Dwayne there when you left that morning? Yes. And did you get a phone call? Yes. And where was it from? From my home. Did you talk to him? Yes. And she starts letting it all out in a very cathartic way. And she said to me the following, which sticks in my brain forever. She said, Brian, I chose my kids over Dwayne, and I'm sorry. And she wanted to make it right. I wrote an affidavit. She signed it, and I submitted that to the DA. And so that was step one.
In the affidavit, she recanted her testimony at trial, swearing that the ADA, quote, told me he did not believe me, that I was not a good person, that he was going to take my children away by calling Child Protective Services, and that I was going to go to jail for a very long time. I would never see my children again. These threats are why I gave the testimony I did. I mean, there's a special place in hell for people that would do that to her and, of course, to you. So let's talk about these phone records.
The whole damn case comes down to phone records. It's a landline phone record. If he's there at Erica's house, he cannot be at the crime scene. Can't do it. I drove it. You can't do it. So I subpoena the phone company. Nope. Subpoena the cops. Nope. Subpoena the DA. Nope. And so I go see Dwayne and I say to him, this is the only time I curse in a documentary. I said, I can't find these fucking phone records. I'm so sorry. And I start crying. I put my head against the glass. And this man, who's in a cell that he can almost touch side to side, brought me peace. And brought me grace and said, hey, it's all right. The truth is going to come out. So, Dwayne, how did you stay so damn peaceful in there and then transfer that peace to me?
Yoga.
Okay, good, all right.
How did the phone records magically appear?
So I had all these affidavits from Simon, Erica, and I go to the DA. I'm like, this guy's innocent, didn't do it. And she says this. She says, just like that. She flapped her hand at me and says, all you fast-talking Yankee lawyers from big firms, come down here, say your system's broken, say the guys are innocent, he's guilty, you're going to watch him die. And Jesus, I had all that I could not to channel my inner, you know, my dad's a union carpenter from New Jersey, doesn't take shit from anybody. I said to her, I'll be back, like Terminator style. But I didn't know I was going to be able to be back. And so we had a hearing coming up in which we were going to present all the evidence, all the affidavits. And before that hearing, we get an email like I've never seen before. And the email is from the prosecutor, the one who did that to me. She sent it to the judge and my co-counsel. And she says, to the purpose of the email, to let you know that the HPD officer in charge of the investigation of the Brown trial, Breck McDaniel, found a box of documents over the weekend while spring cleaning his garage. I mean, I am not kidding. And my co-counsel in Dallas gets the box, Megan. And, you know, I call her, I was like, hey, what's in there? And she's like, it just looks like stuff we've seen before. So I kind of hang up figuring this was just a nothing. And then about an hour later, I get a call. They say, check your email, phone records. Maybe I'm not that good of a lawyer after all. Maybe I'm just freaking lucky. It was in his garage in a box. But here is what's worse. I know, how could it get any worse? But here's what's worse. Attached to that phone record was a subpoena from Dan Rizzo, the prosecutor, to the phone company, dated the day after Erica testified about the phone call in the grand jury. Dan Rizzo sent a subpoena, signed it, got the records back from the phone company, and never turned them over to his defense lawyer, Loretta Muldrow, to me as his habeas lawyer, or anyone else. And yet they were found in a cop's garage in 2013. This is a classic what's called Brady violation, which is a constitutional violation when you don't turn over exculpatory records as a prosecutor. And they agreed to a new trial without a hearing, which I've been told in Texas never happens. And so we waited for 17 months because a stable of Republican judges was up for election on the appellate court, and they were never going to give Duane a new trial in an election year. But in November of 2014, they were all reelected, these judges, and the day after that reelection, they issued an order formally vacating his conviction and ordering a new trial.
They came the night before. And the lady told me to pack up, you on the chain. So they don't never let you know what's going on here. They just come to your door and just tell you what you got to do. I started packing my stuff up. And the next morning, they came and got me around, I don't know what time it was. They came and got me and put me in the van. That van is, you can't see out of it, you handcuffs. If they have an accident, if you don't die, you really going to be hurt. They got me to the county. Once again, I was back with nothing, and they had some guys that was already there waiting to go to trial. That was from Death Row, I knew. And they just started giving me, you know, soap stuff, toothpaste and stuff like that, hygiene. And I didn't know what was going to happen after that. I just was just in there.
So that's November 2014, around the turn of the year, around December, he actually goes back to population. And the DA, who was changed by then, actually the DA who gave him the new trial, his name is Mike Anderson. He died of cancer. He authorized the new trial. His wife, Devin Anderson, who took over as DA, was in charge of reinvestigating the crime to see if there were going to be a retrial. And so the only benefit to those 17 months that I talked about at the appellate court was that the Houston Chronicle was all over this. They had pressured and said, you know, they're following the DA. What are you going to do? What are you going to do about Brown? And then on June 8th, 2015, Duane's released.
My lawyer, Catherine, she came to see me. And I'm like, what's going on? She like, did you see the TV? I'm like, no, what's on the TV? She like, you getting out. When she said that, I started crying. I'm like, man, don't play with me. Nah, this is not the time to play like that. But she was for real. And when she left, the guards came. The guard, he normally would handcuff me in the back. This time he didn't put no handcuffs on me. He just walked me to my cell and said, when you're ready, just let me know. Hit the button. I got up there. I went to the cell. I looked in there. I said, man, I don't want nothing out of here. I turned around and I gave all the stuff to the guys that was already there. And I left. He walked me out.
And Dwayne, you said on the steps outside the prison that you have no hate in your heart for what they did to you and that you can't trust everyone, but you can love everyone.
That was the first thing that came out. The first thing I thought about, and I just said it.
That's like some Mandela shit right there.
it is Mandela shit.
Holy Dwayne, man. Amazing. So, Brian, can you explain to us this madness of the civil suit?
When people are exonerated, there's a hodgepodge of laws across the country where some states you don't get anything. In Texas, the statute is actually fairly generous. It's $80,000 a year for every year you're in, plus the same amount in an annuity going forward. So it gets broken out over his life. So Dwayne would get about $2 million, $1 million up front and a million broken out. But in order for that to happen, the district attorney has to file what's called an affidavit of actual innocence. When he was released in 2015, the DA, Devin Anderson, just said, I don't have enough evidence to go forward. That's not the same thing as actually innocent. So we asked for an independent special counsel, and the special counsel was appointed, a man named John Raley. And after 10 months, John Raley issued a lengthy report declaring Dwayne actually innocent. The DA agrees. The court signs an order. We send that to the comptroller, and he denies it. We heard that back channel, the attorney general wrote a letter to the comptroller saying don't pay him because the Houston Police Union still thinks Dwayne did it. And so we had to file a petition in the Texas Supreme Court. And in December 2020, finally, the Texas Supreme Court ruled that the comptroller's denial was improper. And so the court ordered the comptroller to pay Dwayne. Lo and behold, finally, after all these years. And so now the whole legal team feels finally a sense of relief. But there's still one thing left, is accountability for Dan Rizzo, the ADA. Dan Rizzo has a bar hearing. I believe he should be disbarred.
At a minimum. And it's important not to gloss over this particular fact, which is that in 2018, as part of the civil suit, Kim Ogg, who's the current DA, disclosed a long concealed email between Rizzo, the ADA, and Detective McDaniel, which happened the day after Dockery's testimony at the grand jury hearing. And McDaniel, referring to the hidden phone records that Rizzo had subpoenaed, said, and I quote, I was hoping that it would clearly refute Erica's claim that she received a call at work. But it looks like the call detail records from the apartment shows that the home phone dialed Erica's place of employment at about 8:30 a.m. and again at 10:08 a.m. They knew, they always knew, and they deliberately suppressed, withheld, lied, and conspired to send an innocent man to death row. And then, I don't know this, but I'm just going to speculate, they probably went home that night and had a nice dinner, watched a little TV, and went to bed. And I just don't understand what makes people like that tick.
What I have found in the last 5 years, though, is the beauty of strangers to Dwayne. The beauty of those who hear his story, including you, Jason. I am forever touched by the generosity of those who have heard his story and offered to help him. My church agreed to help buy him a truck. After the Netflix documentary, we heard from folks across the world asking how they could help. And we set up a GoFundMe page that raised nearly $13,000 that we've now taken down because he's been compensated. And Dwayne has asked if you're motivated by this story to donate to the Innocence Project and other similar organizations.
Before I sign off and let you guys have the final words, the book is Grace and Justice on Death Row by Brian Stolarz. So now this is the closing part of our show. We call it, appropriately enough, closing arguments. First of all, I thank both of you guys for being here today and sharing this amazing story of courage and perseverance. And then I turn my microphone off. I kick back, close my eyes, and let you guys talk about whatever you want to say for the final word. So first we're going to do Brian Stolarz and then Dwayne Brown, death row exoneree. Over to you guys.
Thank you. And thank you so much for having us. Dwayne's story has been the sort of the blessing of my life. I am honored to tell it. But the reason why we tell it is so that there won't be future Dwaynes. Dwayne will always tell me there's more of me out there. And the only way to change it is through the power of the story. And what we need is accountability for those in power who do this, so there are no future Dwaynes. And it is truly my honor and privilege to tell this story. And Dwayne, I just love you like a brother, and I'm so glad that you are free. Over to you.
Trust no one, but love everybody, and thank y'all for listening and watching.
Don't forget to give us a fantastic review wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps. And I'm a proud donor to the Innocence Project, and I really hope you'll join me in supporting this very important cause and helping to prevent future wrongful convictions. Go to innocenceproject.org to learn how to donate and get involved. I'd like to thank our production team, Connor Hall and Kevin Wardis. The music in the show is by 3-time Oscar-nominated composer Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us on Instagram at Wrongful Conviction and on Facebook at Wrongful Conviction Podcast. Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom is a production of Lava for Good Podcasts in association with Signal Company No. 1.